Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien with Chris Sullivan and Kate Stone at the anchor's desk as well. We've heard of tiny homes, now luxury tiny homes. It's a trend locally, according to Architectural Digest. And while tiny homes have been used in the past to bridge the gap between the haves and have-nots in housing, this is a different beast. MyNorthwest.com content editor Bill Kazarba joins us now. And Bill, these aren't the container homes we're used to seeing.
Yeah, this is a completely different animal. It's something that if you saw a picture of it, in fact, Architectural Digest are the people who did the story originally. If you saw the pictures, you'd think you're looking at a really nice home.
Absolutely. Describe it for us since we're on the radio.
Well, I'd say the biggest thing is that you're looking at fixtures and sizes of rooms that are really utilized in a way that you can't tell it's 350 feet. It's sconces and fine wood being used and window treatments and all the things that you would see in something that was very luxurious, including gourmet kitchens, that kind of thing.
Wow, they squeeze all that into 380 square feet?
Yeah, that's the biggest one.
That's the biggest.
That's
What's
the
smallest?
Biggest one? Smallest one goes down to about 100.
So, well, yeah, where do they put all the stuff? I mean, is this one of those places where then, you know, you bring the bed up and out pops a couch in the same general area where you hide things and they have multiple purposes? I mean, how do you do it?
When you get down to the 100-foot ones, yes. But also there are lofts where people sleep. So the lofts are, if you sat up, you'd hit your head on the ceiling. And in the kitchens, everything is kind of miniaturized. So you have a gourmet stove, but it's not like what you're used to in a big home. It's kind of, you know, 3 feet wide, but you can still create all this stuff. And a lot of the space that's not included in the square footage would be in porches that are covered and things and entrances to the home. So they're really neat. And they're also very visually stunning.
They are. Yeah, the picture on MyNorthwest.com is what caught my eye. And then I thought, okay, I want to talk to Bill about this. The price is stunning. And it makes me think that these aren't being used to bridge the housing gap.
Yes, that's what I saw too.
Yeah.
30 years ago when I moved to Seattle, I paid $175,000 for a house on Queen Anne.
Whoa.
Now a mini home, a mini luxury home is going for $380,000 for 350 square feet.
Who is buying these?
That's unbelievable.
Who's buying these?
Oh, that's a good question. It's something that people are looking at. One of the things that's noted in the article by Architectural Digest is that some people buy them to just hook on the back of their truck and take out in the middle of nature so they can be glamping in their 350-foot home.
Wow, so that's a mobile luxury?
Yes. Some of them got wheels on them.
Yeah, so where are you putting these? I mean, is this one of those things where you can pop it in your backyard, you sublet your yard? I mean, well, do they go on property? Where do these, I mean, zoning issues, where do they go?
Yes, you bring up a lot of good points. One of the real estate brokers that I looked up when we were looking at this says, really be careful with the zoning laws, because you really have to know what you're doing before you buy the home and put it on your property, because oftentimes you're not allowed to. I know my stepdaughter brought her tiny home to Oregon and went to school and parked it in the neighbor's backyard. So she didn't have to pay for any housing.
Wow.
But a lot of them are mobile. A lot of them are meant to be second homes. So people who are really wealthy, but I'm not sure who's going to buy a $380,000
luxury home. 350 square feet. Yeah, I know all these numbers. That's the part that kind of put a bad taste in my mouth, is here we have a housing crisis. We have families, we have individuals desperate to find housing that's affordable and near the jobs where they work. And here we have wealthy, affluent people playing tiny home with $380,000, when that material, that construction could really go to good use.
Yes, I agree. And the other thing about the point you brought up is we did a little poll, unscientific poll on My Northwest, and 60% of people said they'd never live in a home, even on their own, that was under 400 feet.
Although, see, I don't mind the size, it's the price.
Yeah.
I could live just about anywhere, but $380,000 or $350,000 for a tiny home.
I did the math.
Oh, yeah?
For the average American home, that's $1.5 million.
Yeah.
Because the average American home is 2,000 square feet, right? So, when you look at it that way, it's like, okay, yeah, who is buying these and where are they putting them?
And also, don't get me wrong, there are houses that are 100 feet. And are they considered quote-unquote luxury? I don't know. Eye of the beholder, right? But you can get those for under 100.
Okay. But so, 100 square feet.
Yeah.
Again, that's almost just larger than a prison cell.
Yeah. I know. I've lived in 425 square feet, and that was just with a cat. And I can't imagine living in 100 square feet.
Yeah. If you live in Seattle, you're kind of used to tight spaces, or at least a lot of us are.
Are these anywhere right now in Washington?
Yes. Yes. They're all over. They're in suburban Seattle. They're in Port Angeles. They're where else were they?
These Buckley was another spot down there. I could see that down there maybe. Maybe you don't have to buy as big of a spot, you know, because there's a little bit more elbow room down there. But still, it's like, yeah, when I first saw this, I was thinking, oh, yeah, this is great. You know, it's something that'll help with the housing. And then I'm like, yeah, then Colleen and I, we both looked and we're like, whoa.
Be doing okay because, honestly, there's a couple of companies that do nothing but sell these luxury tiny homes locally.
Love to talk to those companies, to each their own, but we're in a housing crisis. Bill, thank you for shining a light on this interesting trend in Seattle. Maybe one of these days I can take a look at one of those myself. Bill Kazarba, you can find his work at mynorthwest.com.
Thank you.
It was a big night for Democrats, as I mentioned in my newscast in New York last night, with three presidents on the stage with a fundraising in their mind. I spoke with CBS's Ed O'Keefe, who's filling in for Margaret Brennan this week on Face the Nation. And the gathering, I wanted to know about the guest list.
This was what the Biden campaign calls the most successful single political fundraising event in American political history. I can't think of any other that's raised that much money, more than $25 million in one pop. So sure, that's a lot of money. And it was done alongside the former presidents, Obama and Clinton, who've been lending their support and their advice to the sitting president, somebody they've known for a long time and have worked with, and who they're eager to see reelected. So they are expected to continue doing this kind of work, fundraising and sort of motivating the base, before eventually getting out there on the campaign trail in various ways, not only for the president, but for Democrats overall, that they try to keep the party united and focused on keeping Donald Trump out of office. And you think to yourself, what do you need $25 million for? Well, the fact that they can raise it now in March, as opposed to, say, late summer or fall, means that they can start opening campaign offices, hiring the people they need to go knock on doors or stand at street corners and find voters, pay for the advertising on the radio and television and online that reaches voters as well. And they're doing it in ways, I tell you, that we haven't seen campaigns be able to do usually until late summer or fall, when people start paying more attention, understandably. But that they can do it now, they think, is what will eventually help them close the gap with former President Trump in the polls, not only in places like Washington State or out west, but across those six or seven battleground states that are going to really matter and tip the scales one way or the other.
Can we trust the polls? It puts President Biden behind former President Trump. But in all of those mentions, they say President Biden has the most money. So is it the polls or is it the money?
It may be one or the other, maybe neither. And there are some surveys that put the president either on par with or slightly ahead of Donald Trump, just as other polls put Trump on par with or slightly ahead of President Biden. So it's close. And it shouldn't surprise anybody that it's close, because most of our national elections now are. And so it becomes a motivation game. And it's who can turn out their loyal supporters and then convince the small handful of Americans who don't seem to have an opinion on either of these guys to show up. And it's going to require that money to do that. Because if you can hit people in their Facebook feed, if you can hit them on the radio as they drive to work, if they can see the billboard, if they get something in the mail, if somebody comes knock on the door, any one or two of those may be enough to convince these people, you're right, I've got to turn out, or I've got to fill out my ballot and send it in the mail and get this done. And that is why there's this sort of quiet confidence, at least among Biden campaign aides, that ultimately they think they can pull this off. Won't be easy, won't be a blowout, but something that they think can ultimately work in their favor. And they turn around and say, look, the former president has to worry about court cases, has to worry about paying off some settlements, and seems more interested in selling copies of the Bible or sneakers than he is in meeting voters across the country that he's going to need to get him reelected.
However, he was last night during that fundraiser for President Biden, apparently visiting the family of an officer killed in the line of duty. What do we know about this case?
He was at a wake for a policeman from Queens in New York City who had been killed, yes, in an incident earlier this week, was invited by the police union to show up and do so. This is the kind of event that the former president likes to do because it allows him to at least raise questions about whether the current president cares about law enforcement. The Biden team would turn around and remind people that as a senator, he was the one that provided more federal funding for community policing, that he's had the support of police unions in the past, that he has great affinity for firefighters and others who do that kind of work. But it was a good opportunity to counter-program the president, who was also in New York, of course, raising money, and not worrying about what the former president believes is a more urgent concern, and that is public safety and the plight of police officers.
That is CBS's Ed O'Keefe, who is filling in for Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation this Sunday. While the former president was visiting the officer's family to build some positive momentum for his campaign, he is still facing multiple legal challenges and figuring out how he's going to pay his legal fees. Seems by day he's in court, then by night he may or may not be back on the campaign trail.
Well, he says he's been able to pone up that roughly $100 million plus in money that he has to pay. He has to pay it, and he has about another 10 days or so to do so. We'll see if he does that. And then, yes, we're waiting on progress in the case in Georgia, which, of course, had some questions raised about the prosecutor. We're waiting on the classified documents case down in Florida, and whether that one will proceed at any point this summer. There's the election interference case here in Washington, which is on hold until the Supreme Court rules on whether or not the president has immunity. That case will be heard next month as well. So plenty of things to occupy his time in the legal space while he also has to worry about campaigning. Ultimately, if he starts ending up in court on a regular basis, the cadence is expected to be court during the day and most of a week when it's in session, and then evening hours or the days when they aren't in session out on the campaign trail. Will that be enough to sustain him and to keep the momentum going? We'll wait and see.
And I'm still waiting to hear some policies from the former president. We have protesters outside that fundraiser hosted by Stephen Colbert calling on President Biden to do more about the war between Israel and Hamas, yet we've heard nothing about what Mr. Trump would do.
That's right. He made some general comments of support about Israel in an interview in the past week, but also suggested that it may have a bit of a PR problem. And that's essentially how he described it, given the fact that so much of the world is concerned about the humanitarian disaster that's unfolding in Gaza. But otherwise, has not really signaled any more specifically how he would be handling this situation. We know he's closely aligned with the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. They're friendly. They've met before. He's expressed, of course, support for Israel to continue its operations. But would he be doing anything any differently? We don't know. And we don't get many opportunities to ask.
Yeah, we'll keep asking until we get closer to the election. Your guest this Sunday, a name I haven't heard in a while, Cindy McCain, the wife of late Senator John McCain. What is she up to?
Well, these days she's the executive director of the World Food Program based in Rome. So she'll join us to talk about some of those humanitarian concerns around the world, not only in Gaza, but also in the Sudan region of Africa. She's been there and is quite concerned about what's unfolding in that part of the world, plus the concern about what's going on in Haiti. We'll also ask her about her family's good friend, the late Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who died this week. And we're going to be joined by the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Turner to talk about whether Congress will pony up the money for Ukraine, for Israel, for Taiwan, and for other security concerns. He wants Congress to do so, but he's waiting on Speaker Johnson to call a vote. We'll get an update on the bridge collapse from the Baltimore mayor, Brandon Scott. And we have a great Easter Sunday conversation with the Cardinal of Washington, D.C., and the Episcopal Bishop of the nation's capital. They're buddies, have worked together in the past, and it's a fantastic conversation that we admittedly taped yesterday because we're a little busy today, tomorrow and Sunday, about the divisions in this country, about how they process all the tough headlines, and what they make of some political developments. I kind of threw it out there, and they ran with it in ways I didn't expect it. I'll have to tune in Sunday to see why.
Yeah, love when that happens. Filling in for Margaret Brennan this Sunday, it's Ed O'Keefe, senior White House and political correspondent. Ed, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you. Take care.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural
features. 6:37 now, and this is All Over the Map with our resident historian, Felix Bunnell. He joins us every Friday morning for this feature. A quick look at the stories behind local places and things. This week, in search of the mysterious origins of a well-known slogan associated with a certain local aerospace giant.
Okay, enough suspense. Now, what is this well-known? I know, who wrote this stuff? What is the well-known slogan or motto we're talking about? To say it for us, here's a guy who lived it.
If it's not Boeing, I'm not going.
I remember. Yes.
Yeah. That's John Purvis. He worked for Boeing in various product support roles from 1956 to 1998, brilliantly timing his career to match the golden age of jet travel and Boeing's golden age, too. Now, I've said before, I'm not a Boeing apologist, but I'm not entirely unbiased about the positive role that Boeing has played in the culture and history of the Pacific Northwest. And heck, they built the B-17s and B-29s that won World War II and the B-52s that are still defending us around the world. Now, clearly, Boeing has had a rough go of it lately with very public problems around what seems to be a corporate culture that no longer puts safety ahead of shareholder value. That debate is raging. That story is being covered by other journalists. You know, some people have even twisted that old slogan around in the wake of the door plug incident on Alaska Airlines. So if it is Boeing, I'm not going, that kind of thing. But back to retired 42-year Boeing employee John Purvis again. What does that old slogan mean to him?
Boeing built not only quality products, but reliable and safe.
And maybe they'll get back to having that reputation again. Now, the mystery I want to explore today is, where does that slogan actually come from? Mike Lombardi is the Boeing archivist and historian. He says he's searched for the origins but has not been able to find anything definitive. He told me in an email it wasn't an official attempt at branding. It sort of emerged organically, but it caught on, and there was never any pushback from Boeing leadership. You can buy stuff at the Boeing store that has it, that slogan on it now, right? They've embraced it, though they didn't come up with it themselves. I did some digging online and found a vintage bumper sticker on eBay that has the slogan, and it says copyright 1979 and the name Dake, D-A-K-E. Mm-hmm. I don't know who that is. Then I found an Emmett Watson column from the old Seattle PI from August 1979 that says, "Have you seen the latest local bumper sticker?" and quotes the slogan. So 1979 seems to be when "if it's not Boeing, I'm not going" became a thing. Why 1979, you might be asking? Some listeners might be old enough to remember the deadliest aviation accident in United States history, American Airlines Flight 191, which crashed on May 25th, 1979. 273 people died at O'Hare Airport in Chicago when a DC-10, that's the flagship product of what was then Boeing's biggest competitor, McDonnell Douglas, lost an engine as it was attempting to take off. This is an old TV report from WMAQ-TV Chicago.
American Airlines was the first to fly the DC-10. It ordered 25 from McDonnell Douglas 11 years ago. Three fan jets keep its 205 tons in the air. The left engine is what apparently sheared away from the wing on takeoff yesterday, possibly causing a loss of hydraulic power. Why? Investigators don't yet know.
They later determined that improper maintenance procedures damaged the pylon that connects the engine to the wing. All DC-10s were grounded for about 6 weeks in June and July, and public hearings were held and covered extensively by the media. Now, in 1979, McDonnell Douglas was Boeing's only serious competitor. Airbus had only one model of jet back then and not much market share. And so the theory is, it was pride in Boeing jets in the wake of that horrific and widely publicized DC-10 crash in Chicago that led someone to create that first bumper sticker. Now, the slogan could have been created earlier, just a statement of pride, not in relation to any particular accident. But whatever the timing, the fact that the slogan was organic, not some corporate thing, is really bizarre. That local people actually remember. Anyway, now, the Museum of Flight is looking into this for me. The Machinist Union is as well. This is where brilliant listeners come in. I know there's got to be someone out there who knows more about this than I do. And you can go to my Facebook page. I've got a picture of that bumper sticker. Hit me up on the text line or send me an email. I'd love to know if there's someone out there in Boeing radio land who remembers where this came from.
If it's not Boeing, I'm not going.
We will get to the bottom of this, Felix.
If it's not Colleen O'Brien, somebody must be lying. If it's not Chris Sullivan, what rhymes with Sullivan? I don't know.
Lots going on this weekend, jam-packed with events. Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden has you covered.
It's Friday then, it's Saturday, Sunday, what? It's Friday then, it's Saturday, Sunday, what?
It's finally here, the weekend, and there are plenty of things going on this holiday weekend. Kicking things off are a couple of conventions.
Vegeta, what does the scouter say about his power level?
It's over 9,000!
The Sakura Con, a convention highlighting the wide world of anime. The Asia Northwest Cultural Education Association puts on the show and says that Sakura Con is the oldest and most well-attended anime convention in the region. You can join in on all the fun at the Seattle Convention Center. In Puyallup, some of the biggest video game voice actors are putting on panels at the Washington State Gaming Expo. There's more than just panels, including plenty of vendors, an arcade, and multiple video game tournaments. The expo runs through the weekend, and you can get tickets and details at wagamingexpo.com. If you're looking for some laughs tonight, Geeky Comedy Seattle is putting on the Bye 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 Comedy Showcase. The event is described as a night of comedy from Seattle's funniest bye performers. You can join in on the laughs at Charlie's Queer Books in Fremont tonight at 8. Watershed Pub is celebrating its 10th anniversary all weekend long. There will be drink and food specials as well as live music. There will even be a talent show, and some of the staff will be spinning some tunes as live DJs. The Watershed Pub is in Northgate. If you are looking for some new threads, the Ballard Hullabaloo is this weekend. The Hullabaloo is when shops and boutiques in Ballard bring their discounted items to the Leif Erickson Hall to sell. According to visitballard.com, most of the merchandise offered is 75% off the original price, and there will also be beer specials. It's Black Punk Weekend at the Northwest Film Forum. There will be films including a showcase of James Spooner's 2003 documentary Afropunk, live performances, and an award ceremony celebrating Kimya Dawson. You can find more tickets and details at nwfilmforum.org. It's the 30th edition of Georgetown Bites on Saturday. Food vendors will be out in the heart of Seattle's oldest neighborhood from 11 to 4, and there will be plenty to eat. Get your tickets at the Georgetown Trailer Park Mall or visit georgetownseattle.org/bites. Easter is on Sunday, and to celebrate, Seattle Parks and Recreation is offering free Easter egg hunts. There are more than 15 hunts being put on at city community centers throughout the region, with most starting around 10 a.m. You can find more information on the Seattle Parks and Recreation website. Test your S-P-L-L-I-N-G with the King Snohomish Regional Spelling Bee on Saturday. Middle schoolers from the region will put their skills to the test for a chance at the nationwide contest in D.C. this summer. Our own Felix Bunnell will be hosting and pronouncing the words for the spellers. It is free and open to the public to attend. You can celebrate the Hindu tradition of Holi on Saturday with two celebrations. Make sure you wear white so you can show off all the colors that you'll be covered in. One celebration, the Seattle Color Festival, is Saturday and free at the Seattle Center starting at 11. The Holi Festival of Color is in Finney Ridge and is at the Finney Center Community Hall at 1 o'clock. You will need a ticket for the Festival of Colors, however. FinneyCenter.org is where to get them. From now until hopefully deep into the fall, the Seattle Mariners are back and are in town until Thursday the 4th. Don't miss out on all the fun this weekend and let me know what's going on in the region for next weekend at PHOLDEN@Bonneville.com. Paul Holden, Cairo News Radio.
Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft, a doctor specializing in people who suffered traumatic injuries, is helping them because he knows exactly what they're going through. Here's CBS's Mark Strassman with the inspiring story.
Squeeze my hand for me. Squeeze it. Squeeze it. Good.
In a world of noisy naysayers, Woody Morgan represents possibility.
Set the bar super high here for what kind of care patients receive.
We can definitely do that.
This is Atlanta's Shepherd Center, a premier facility for patients with brain and spinal cord trauma. In this space, Morgan's often mistaken for a patient.
What? You're my doctor? Are you really in the chair? Or I've had people say, is that chair for me? You know, I'm like, no, 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 this one's mine.
A swimming accident in 2008 left Morgan a broken man. He was 20, a pre-med collegiate soccer player.
Dove into a wave and probably hit a sandbar, or the wave crashed just the wrong way and hit my head down.
Do you remember feeling anything?
No, I was out, so I lost consciousness. Next thing I know, I was in a hospital room.
Two broken vertebrae in his neck, a catastrophic injury leaving him paralyzed from the chest down.
Were you told you might want to rethink that med school dream?
Yeah, in so many words, yeah. Like, all right, well, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to show you how to do it.
In 2015, he graduated in a wheelchair from Tulane Medical School. His specialty, rehabbing patients grappling with a sort of catastrophic injury he had. Dr. John Lynn, Shepherd's director of spinal cord medicine, remembers treating Morgan 16 years ago.
Did you feel in your gut that he would actually go to medical school?
I didn't think so. Mostly because I have heard so many people said they were going to do it and they never make it there.
I never thought he was going to actually do it because this is not a easy injury to overcome.
But Morgan remembers seeing Lynn, his doctor, also paralyzed in a wheelchair because of his own medical condition.
First time you saw him, surprised?
Certainly it was more like an aha moment.
Motivating.
Yes, certainly motivating.
So when we both started from scratch, and that's a difficult journey.
Not only difficult, improbable.
Can you squeeze those fingers in? That's good.
Woody Morgan, Shepherd staff physician.
This is where you always wanted to end up?
Yeah, yeah. I think that was always the goal.
Having been a patient makes you a better physician?
I would agree with that, yeah. Just have a lot more empathy. There we go. Got it.
And a remarkable backstory.
I think it shows you that life is not over. People can get back to driving. People can get back to working. People can get back to being parents and raising kids.
Woody Morgan, wheelchair and all, proof that no dream is broken beyond repair.
Incredible. That is Mark Strassman reporting. 7:47 on Seattle's Morning News, and it's G. Scott time. Hey, you
good
were...
Good morning!
I'm going to guess you were sitting pretty at the Mariners home.
Oh, you know your boy was in the building at T-Mobile Park, home of the Mariners, opening day.
In the building and in the suites?
No, I didn't get invited up to the C-suites.
Oh.
I didn't get those invites to the suites. Those are for the... Here at this radio station, that's for the... For those at the top. I didn't get that. Sully, were you there?
No. Are you kidding me? Going to bed at the time I was in bed before the game, before first pitch.
Were you really?
Yeah.
It was when first was pitch? 7:10.
7:10.
Yeah, I fell asleep.
By Thursday nights, man, I'm spent.
I was out by 8.
We can't
hang, G. Yeah. We can't hang.
Yeah. Save it up for the weekend, right? And get a nap early to bed, yeah.
Yeah. So, how was it? It reminded me of a bunch of people trying to get back with their ex was in the building.
Okay, explain that. Explain that.
We love the Mariners so much.
We do.
The Mariners for the last 20 years has just, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we're there. We love you. We are here. Even though people keep telling us that you're not the one, doesn't matter. We're here. T-Mobile Park, beautiful. The fans in the building, beautiful.
They're all dressed up for the Mariners.
It was so great. The night was buzzing. And then it lost 6-4. Now, I know. So you're going to say, well, there's so much baseball left. I get it. But it's just sometimes it's just that night you wanted to get it right. It's like wedding night. You know what I mean? You want to get that night right, right? Like at least opening day. Yeah. Win this game. I'm not saying that you got to go undefeated. I'm just saying you got to have that. And then the first four batters in the lineup, J.P. Crawford, Julio Rodriguez, those guys, they were 3-for-15. They were 3-for-15.
What does that mean?
Meaning they only had 3 hits after 15. Like, we need them top of the order. Yeah. We need them hitting. So I know it might sound like I'm upset. I'm not. Mm-hmm. Because it was such a good night. It was beautiful.
What'd you eat?
Just had some peanuts.
Okay.
You know, I just had some peanuts.
Boring.
By the way, the food choices, off the chain.
Tell me.
Like, every...
First of all, it's hard to do a ball game, ballpark food on G's regimen. Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to go there.
Sugar. Yeah. No, I've had sugar. But no bread. I've had no bread. And it's just like, I'm going to tell you the place that was packed, Kid Valley stays packed. Yeah. Right? Kid Valley is just, I don't know. Somebody be like, I don't know. Kid Valley, safe.
It's the ranch dressing. They have got good ranch.
I think it's also because they serve Coors Light in draft.
Right. Now, see, Sully, we're having a good conversation. You got to bring up beer.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to be real here. I mean, the Kid Valley's great, but I think it might be because that one on left field. I think because they got Coors Light on draft.
Right. Yeah,
but do they serve it with pimento olives?
What?
Clean. Man, it's Good Friday, girl.
Every time somebody mentions Coors Light, I have to bring up the Spokane delicacy, which is Coors Light with some martini olives. It's like having your hydration with a little snack. It's so good. Try it. Don't knock it till you try it.
I got to try it.
Yeah.
As far as food choices, I'm not the one to ask, but, yo, it was jamming. It was really jamming. It had a lot. I mean, you could not go a couple steps without some type of food choice. They were in there. So there was that.
I probably hung out too much at the bullpen. Mm. Yeah, I hung out there. You go head
Hold
towards
on.
Left
you
field.
You got to go to the bullpen?
Well, there's this area for everyone called the bullpen.
Yeah, he wasn't warming up to go in the seventh inning.
Nah. Way to bury the lead. You're hobnobbing with the Mariners and didn't even tell us. Okay, the actual, the social. Yeah.
So the social part of it. Yeah. I got to admit, Sully, Colleen, it might have been too much fun.
I'm with you. It can be fun in the bullpen.
It was fun. But again, you know, I'll be back again on Sunday. Because, this year I'm going to 20-plus games. Like, that's going to be my thing.
Is that a goal?
It's just, I want to just fall in love with the Mariners, right? And I just, it's great what they have put together. So everything is in place, Colleen. This relationship is ready to go to the World Series. All they need to do is perform.
Exactly. Yeah, you're there. You're a great fan. You're a good partner. You're enjoying yourself. You're going to go to 20 plus. You're putting in the time. You're putting in the effort. Mm-hmm. Now the Mariners need to show that they're worthy of your love.
Bigger question right now to tie it into what I love.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Did you park at Angle Lake and take a light rail in?
No.
Just asking. Okay, no, did you drive or are you taking public transit?
Wait. I'm glad you're bringing that up, Sully. Great point. I need to get better. Because here's what happened. Colleen, I had this plan. I was like, okay, yeah, we're going to go to the game. My buddy went with me. We're going to go to the game. You know what we're going to do? We're going to go to Cairo, go out to my work, and I'm going to park there, and then we're going to take a little Uber there. And then I got lazy. I'm like, I ain't doing that.
How much was parking?
$80. I mean, so I need to do better. Like, whatever, but I'm like, I don't need to be doing that every time. So Sully needs to come up with a plan for people coming south and for people coming from the north or from the east. Like, what is your plan? What's the most efficient way to do it?
Some days for you from Tacoma, depending on the series, you could do a Sounder train. They run Sounders from Tacoma.
Is that public transportation?
Yeah, it's a good train. That. Yeah, okay.
Thank you, G.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthwest.com.